Hello, this is Gideon Rothstein, and this is Perek Zion of Sefer Amos, chapter 7 of the book of Amos. And this is a chapter that is revelatory of new and different themes than we've seen until now, and also is largely teaches us by learning more about the atmosphere within which Amos functioned and the ways in which he functioned within that atmosphere, rather than any particular nevuot that we learn that he's giving the Jewish people about their future. Because the Perek opens up, Pasuk Aleph in Perek Zion in chapter 7, Kohir Ani Hashem Lakimi tells us, Hashem showed him, Vine Yotzer Govai V'tchilat Alo Talakash, that he was creating a locust plague at the beginning of the time when the crops were about to sprout, to come out. Vine Lekesh Achar Gizeh HaMelech, and there is these crops, these late-sown crops that are coming to be ready for harvesting. So the locust would really wipe out the entire harvest, right? The late harvest, at least, and would be a terrible destruction. So Amos sees this in the Nevuah, and he understands that this locust would finish, would devour, would destroy all of the grasses, all of the produce, all of the harvest, all of the grain, and there would be nothing to eat. So Amos says in the Nevuah, Hashem Elokim, please forgive. How are the Jewish people going to be able to survive? Miyakum Yaakov ki katonu. Katonu here meaning unable to stand all of this punishment. So as the Ramban Chumash points out, katonti, when Yaakov talks to Hashem in Parshat Vayishlach, it says katonti mikol chasadim, he means I am unworthy of. So the term katon can be used in the sense of not meeting up to the standards of. So here too, katon ki katonu. So what happens? Nicham Hashem al zot, and Hashem says, fine, I won't do it. Lo tia amar Hashem, it won't happen. So these three psukim, not necessarily that it's relevant to any of us because we are not, as far as I know, any of us Nevi'im, but these three psukim and the next three psukim will do the similar thing, but they give us an insight into the way Nevuah worked, that I'm not sure that we would have had. It's not a passive experience. We've seen this with Moshe Rabbeinu, we know that there, but there it's more emphatic. So here you might have thought that in later dates, we wouldn't have realized that there's a give and take between the Navi and HaKadosh Baruch Hu, apparently the Navi and the Nevuah. See, he sees a Nevuah. I could easily imagine that you're a Navi, you have the privilege of having Dvar Hashem be given to you. Your job is to listen to it, to hear it, to take it, to transmit it, and that's it. And that's as far as it goes. So when Amos says, but Hashem, the Jews can't stand it. They're too katan, they're too small, they're unable to bear such a punishment. I would have thought that was chutzpah, that was overly daring. But apparently Hashem either wants it, it's unclear. Certainly Hashem accedes to it. I think it might even be true that Hashem wants it. And that part of the role of Navi is that part as well. Although that's not a part that Navi regularly reports to us. It's nonetheless part of the experience of the Navi is to try to argue with Hashem or try to suggest to Hashem. And it also shows that there is no relish among the Nevi'im in predicting destruction. So here, the destruction is too great. He can't resist. He can't help himself. And he says, Hashem, it's too much. Also, I would mention that there is a Gemara in Chulin Daf Samach Amid Bet, just it's a well-known Gemara, but it's interesting how it fits into our context. The Gemara there talks about the sun and the moon. It's a famous, people know this Medrash, this idea that the moon complained to Hashem that originally the sun and the moon were the same size, and the moon said, how can you have two things be the same exact size? Hashem says, good idea, you can't have that, so you go and make yourself smaller. And the moon complains because it says, I had the good idea, why should I get punished? Whole discussion there. So in that discussion there, however, the Agadah should be understood, but in that discussion there, at some point Hashem decides to try to mollify the moon and just give it all these ways to make it feel better about its lot. So Hashem says, you know what, I'll have the tzaddikim be called like you, katan, small. And so Yaakov HaKatan, right here we see that the people, the Jewish people, are being referred to as Yaakov and being katon. And that's so the Gemara raises that as a possibility as some kind of a good thing. So there seems to be some kind of an implication here that being katon, being small, or seeing yourself as unworthy, or seeing yourself as unable to bear up under certain things, maybe there's some advantage that, or some, the humility part of it is some kind of a positive element. In any case, Pasuk Dalet, then he has another vision. So first he saw the locust coming, that was too much. So then he sees Hashem creating a fire, getting ready to have a fire to argue and fight with the people below for the things that they've done wrong, and it's going to destroy Chelkat Achelek. So the Radak thinks that means the king's lands first, and this fits in with a theme we've seen the Radak stress many times. The Radak thinks the reason why the king's lands would be destroyed first is that the king is largely responsible for what's happening to the Jewish people. And the reason why the king is largely responsible for the Jewish people is because had the king only been different, the people would have been different as well. That's all a question about leadership and its role and the people's ability and willingness to follow their leaders. That is a whole question that comes up many times, but here is as insinuated as well. And that's what's going on according to the Radak, that the threat is that Hashem will send out fire to destroy the entire people, but starting from the king's plot of land, because the king is really the most responsible for what's going wrong. So he says, Hashem, please stop. How can the Jewish people stand that? They're too small, they're too unable to stand up and bear that level of punishment. So Hashem also steps back from giving that punishment and says it won't be. So two examples, two times in this parak that Amos has averted what would have been a catastrophic destruction of the Jewish people. So then the next day is another vision. Now Hashem is standing over a chomat anach, and he has in his hand an anach. So an anach, in its simple English, is a plumb line. So pasuk chet, let me just go on. Vayomer Hashem elai mata. Right? So Hashem says to mata Amos, what do you see, Amos? Vayomer anach, I see a plumb line. A plumb line is a weighted line that you hold, that you can dangle, and therefore see if you're building straight or not, because the plumb line always goes straight down to the ground because it's weighted, so you can see whether your wall or whatever you're constructing is straight or not. Vayomer Hashem, hineni sam anach bekerav ami Yisrael. So Hashem says, I'm going to put a plumb line on the Jewish people, and here it means a form of a punishment. It's going to use the plumb line as a standard of measurement of whether they deserve punishment or not. Lo sif odav or lo, I'm not going to any longer forego their bad behavior. So pasuk tev, v'nashamu v'mot Yisrak, and they will be desolate, the high places of Yisrak. We'll talk about why it's Yisrak in a second. The Radak talks about the fact that Amos refers to the Jewish people as Yisrak, as being the descendants of Yitzchak here, rather than descendants of Abraham or Yaakov. V'mikdash Yisrael yecharavu, and their temples, their sanctuaries will be destroyed. V'kam to Beit Yeravam becharav, and I'm going to come against the house of Yeravam by the sword. So the chomat anach and the I'm going to bring an anach. So Rashi says he needs some anach. He needs shofet otam bekav shirat adin. Right, it's going to be a straight line of the judgment, of the punishment, of the judgment that they deserve, of the actual justice of what that would be. So the Radak thinks that here. So the Radak notices that here Amos doesn't do any complaining. Right, he has the vision and there's no complaint, and then Hashem says to him, what are you seeing? And Amos says, I see an anach, and then Hashem explains it. So the Radak says, why is it that he didn't complain here? So Radak says, because he didn't see a destruction. There wasn't mass destruction. It was, they are going to be judged with times of trouble, yisurin, uvegalut, and exile. And so he doesn't say anything because that's only what they deserve. That's really the minimal punishment that they deserve for what they've done wrong. And therefore, he doesn't either feel the need, perhaps, or feel the capability. Meaning, it could be, it's not clear in the Radak what the Radak understands. When we see Amos complaining, is it that Nevi'im have an absolute right to protest Hashem's justice, Hashem's decisions about how to judge the Jewish people? Or is it only when Hashem's justice or Hashem's judgment is going over some line? So you can't say that Hashem was planning on being unjust and Amos protested and therefore Hashem decided to be just. That's intolerable as a statement about how Hashem works and functions. But you might say, I think you can say, that Hashem, the original plan as it were, was to be at a certain level of strictness of justice, and Amos was able to point out that that level was a level the people could not tolerate, even though it itself was also just. But then there's another level of justice, another level of punishment. So here, what the Ratak is understanding it to be is to be exile and suffering. So that's the kind of thing that doesn't produce destruction. It produces trouble and it produces sadness. It produces hard times. But that it was within either Amos's, it's not clear, either perhaps his capabilities, but or his desires to protest that. And then he points out on Bamot Yitzchak that the Bamot here is a reference to the fact that the Jewish people, the Northern Kingdom especially, have made places of worship of their own, as we'll see in the next section of the Perek. So why refer to them as descendants of Yitzchak? Because the prime event of Yitzchak's life that we know is that he was Ne'ekad, he was bound onto an altar, and so it's a reference to the fact that we are abandoning the tradition of our forefather Yitzchak by having such altars and such events going on. So, if we stopped here, and we're not going to, obviously, but if we stopped here, after the first nine psukim of this parak, what we have is two occasions in a row when Amos has a vision of terrible destruction and manages to get Hashem to avert it. A third occasion where the judgment being applied is more moderate, and the punishments involved are more moderate, and therefore, Amos doesn't say anything, and therefore the judgment is going to, in fact, come through that they are going to be exiled and there's going to be desolation in the land of Israel because of, and the house of the king, house of Yeravam, will die by the sword, and all of that is so fully deserved and not so disruptive to the national continuity of the Jewish people that Amos either doesn't want to, or at least as likely, or certainly likely, cannot protest that. Now this pasuk of Chomat Anach also is interesting to me because it is cited in the Gemara in Bava Metzia, Daf Nun Tet Amud Aleph. So the Gemara in Bava Metzia, Daf Nun Tet Amud Aleph, Amud Bet, is very well known because it has in it the story of the Tanur Shel Achnai, where Rabbi Ezra ben Hurkanus and the Chachamim and the sages of his time were having an argument about a certain halachic topic, and Rabbi Ezra tried to prove his point by calling on all sorts of interventions to prove that he was right and that God thought he was right. And at the climax of the story, Yeshua stands on his feet and he says, Lo b'shamayim, the Torah is not in heaven, and that's why the rabbis get to win and the majority gets to rule. And even though it seems like in the story is not clear in many different ways, but it seems like in the story that Eliezer was in some technical way more right, more correct than the other opinion, nonetheless the other opinion which has the majority wins the day. That's a story that everybody knows. Everybody knows that Rabbi Ezra ben Hurkanus calls upon all these remarkable supernatural interventions. A tree jumps and a river turns its way and the walls of the Beit Midrash almost fall down. They don't fall down. People know that story and it's an entertaining and an interesting story. But years ago it struck me that we don't always recognize the context in which it's brought up. It's brought up in the context of a discussion of ona'ah, which is fraud, when you overcharge or undercharge or underpay, but you overcharge for an item. And there the Gemara relates ona'ah in the financial sense to ona'ah dvarim, to teasing and to persecuting somebody by your speech, by how you speak to them. And so this discussion is really brought up, this pasuk is really brought up there in the Gemara above Metzia, because the Gemara says, "Kol ha'sha'arim nin'alim chutz misha'arei ona'ah." All of the gates of heaven can be locked up and closed, meaning you can't have Hashem hear you and respond to your complaints or your cries, except for ona'ah. Ona'ah will always be people who are either defrauded or who are teased for things about them inappropriately. They are verbally persecuted. Those will always find a hearing in heaven. And then Rabbi Elazar says right there also that hakol nifra bidei shaliach chutz me'ona'ah, everything when Hashem intervenes in the world and punishes various crimes, it's always by a messenger of some sort, except for ona'ah, which is not done by a messenger, which is done directly by Hashem. That is the lead-in to the discussion of Rabbi Elazar ben Hurkanus. And the point of that story is at the end of that story, when they put Rabbi Elazar ben Hurkanus into cherim or nidu, when they excommunicate him or ban him because he insisted on following his argument through to the end and didn't give up and didn't just say, well, the majority won, I have to bow to the will of the majority, so they put him in communication, and then he is very upset about it and he cries about it and he's upset about it, and there is all discussion in which it becomes clear that he is seen as being a recipient of ona'ad dvarim, somebody who suffered ona'ad dvarim, and it's seen there that Hashem steps in and actually punishes other people even though they were right, or even though they did the right thing, but they get somewhat of punishment, they have the threat of punishment upon them for having created this ona'ah, for having created this sense of verbal persecution, because that's ona'ah. So that all seems to stem from here, and then if you take that Gemara at face value, it would suggest that when Hashem says here, I'm standing on a chomat anach, so the Radaket said, I didn't mention, but the Radaket said, it's talking about the Sanhedrin in general, and about the lack of proper justice in general, so Hashem is going to institute justice to make up for the justice that they didn't do, but the Gemara seems to be taking it as being even more directly about ona'ah, whether financial or verbal or oral, that's the punishment that's going on there. Now that's one section of the Perek, and there's a Parsha Petucha between the two, so that in the traditional Nevi'im, there's a full break here before the next part. But then, especially when Chazal understand that last piece of being about verbal teasing and verbal inappropriateness and taunting, so the next part of the Perek fits in very nicely, because in Pasuk Yud, Vayishlach HaMatziah Kohen Beit El, El Yeravam Melech Yisrael Lemor, so the we've seen many times that there were these agalim, there was this egel in Beit El. In Beit El, which is the nearer to the capital city of Shomron, there was a golden calf, and by this point in the history of the northern kingdom, they're actually worshipping the calf itself. It's not clear whether Yeravam, when he originally made the calf, Yeravam who was broke off from the southern kingdom, it's not clear whether that Yeravam meant the calf to be an idol worship or not. It's quite possible he didn't mean it to be. He only meant it to be a competitor to the Beit HaMikdash, to the temple, but did not mean it to be a worship of its own. But by this time, they have their own Kohanim, they have their own priest, and he is bothered by Amos. So he sends a note or a message to Yeravam, the king of Yisrael at this time, the king of the northern kingdom, and he says, "Kashar alech Amos. Amos is rebelling against you. Bekerav Yisrael, among the Jewish people, l'tuchal ha'aretz l'achil kol dvarav. The land can't bear." What he's saying. Pasuk Yud Aleph, what does he say he's saying? He's saying the king is going to die by the sword. And the northern kingdom, Israel, will be exiled from its land. So both Rashi and Rashi point out that Amos did not in fact say that. He didn't say Yeravam will die. He said Beit Yeravam, the house of Yeravam. And indeed, the next generation of Yeravam's family does in fact get killed by the sword, as you can see by looking it up in Sefer Melachim. But that's what Amatziah sends to Yeravam, again giving us a sense of the atmosphere within which Amos is forced to work, forced to function, in that he's got this competitor, right? Amatziah is a big religious leader of the time. He's the Kohen of Beit El, and there are apparently a lot of people going to Beit El. It's not like a neglected worship, and so he's got to struggle with this, he's got to contend with this. Now, it could have been, theoretically, Yeravam would have said this to him. In this case, it seems like Yeravam, the king, ignores Amatziah. That's the way the Radak understands Pasuk Yud Bet, because in Pasuk Yud Bet, Vayomer Amatziah Lamos, Chozel Lech Brech Lecha El Eretz Yehuda. He says to him, you know, you visionary, you seer, go off to the southern kingdom, Vechol Sham Lechem Vesham Tinaveh, and there, give your prophecies, and Rashi says, get your crumbs, get your bread that you get, that they used to give people food for their nevuot. That was the way some nevi'im, some prophets would have to find some form of support by doing that, so that you would get some bread, some food, for giving a nevuah, for giving a prophecy. So it's interesting. So Amatzi here is giving us a lot of insight, I think, into the times in which he's functioning, and that's the way the Radak understands it as well, that even though the capital is in Shomron, he, Amatziah in Beit El, is a powerful figure, and he is trying to rid himself of the problem of Amos. But the way, I just was mentioning before, the way that he speaks to him is exactly an example of Ona'at Dvarim, exactly the kind of an idea where Hashem would, according to the Gemara in Bavitzia, step in without a shaliach to save or protect Amos from what's going on here. So he says, also Rashi says, and the way Rashi puts it then, puts another twist on it, he says, why does he go to Yehuda? Because in Yehuda, they have the Beit HaMikdash, right? That's where the Mikdash is, and there you can give the vote in the name of Hashem. So that would imply, if you took Rashi as being reflective of, as being accurate in his reflection of what's going on in the Northern Kingdom, would mean that the worship of Beit El and the sins of Yeravam had not only penetrated in terms of keeping the people from Yerushalayim, but also giving the Northern Kingdom a sense of itself as separate spiritually from the Southern Kingdom. The Southern Kingdom is where they talk about Hashem. We in the Northern Kingdom talk about something else. That's what Amatziah is saying to him and is telling him. When he says, and don't come back to give nevuot in Beit El, don't think you're going to come back and give your nevuot here, Because here, Rashi says, we're into idol worship. This is Mikdash Melech. This is, meaning Beit El, this calf, this egel, is the worship of the king. And this is where the king and the throne sits and focuses. So that's Amatzia's claim, right? We have conquered the northern kingdom. We are in charge of the northern kingdom. We are the spiritual leaders of the northern kingdom. Don't get involved here. So that, before we see Amos's answer, but that kind of an attitude, I said that this parak doesn't have so many ramifications for our days, but I do think that that's the kind of an attitude you can see in our times when there are people who just say, well, this is our spiritual tradition and don't bother to question it, even though it may be false and wrong and completely wrong-headed, but they nonetheless say, well, that's our spiritual tradition and this is what we focus on. So that's brought up by Amatz, right? Amatz is not an irreligious figure. He has a religion and he thinks this is what we do, and he recognizes there's a HaKadosh Baruch Hu religion too. That's for off somewhere else. So that whole idea of being confident that whatever you have in your hands is right and true without being willing to be critical of what you have and what you practice is an attitude that you see here in Amatzia. So Pasuk Yudalad Vayan Amos Vayomer Amatzia, Amos says to Amatzia, Lo Navi Anochi, Lo Navi Anochi, a phrase that reverberates through Jewish history when you want to speak about yourself with some humility in terms of your ability to, well, you'd bring it up if you ever tried to say something about the future. You'd say, you'll say, I'm not a Navi, I'm not a Ben Navi, I'm not pretending to any deeper insight. But that's not what Amos here means in this context, because that's obviously not true of him. He is a Navi. But what he means here is, Amatzia had implied, if not said straight out, that one part of the motivation for Amos to be giving his Nevuot was financial. Right? She says to him, go to the southern kingdom and get your food there from Nevuah. So that's what Amos here comes to disabuse, that's the notion he comes to disabuse him of. He comes to tell him, I'm not a Navi and a Ben Navi. It's not like a family business that we go into Nevuah to try to make our living. That's the way the Radak understands it. Rashi says, we're not from the Nevi'e HaSheker. We're not from the false prophets who prophesy, and there it's clearly financial because they don't have any prophecy, Radak didn't say this, I'm sorry, just Rashi says it, and they make a living by it. It's a profession, it's a choice. I once years ago heard an interview by Jerry Seinfeld. Talks about the fact that when he went into comedy, it's not yet clear to you, I hope, why his discussion of comedy will be relevant to our discussion of Amos, but he says when he went into comedy, it was just what he had to do, what he loved, it was what he wanted to do. He wanted to be a comedian. He didn't know of anything else. He couldn't imagine anything else. And then he says, nowadays, whenever he's given the interview, it's a choice. It's a career option. You could be a doctor, you could be a lawyer, you could be a comedian. So that seems to be some of what Amos is saying here too. When you tell me that I should go off to the southern kingdom, to Yehuda, to give my nevuot, you are implying that I'm doing it as a career option, as a family thing, right? My father was a Navi Sheker. My father was a Navi. Rashi would say a Navi Sheker. My father was a Navi. My grandfather was a Navi. I want to be a Navi. I'm a Navi. So that's what I am. So I'm just saying that that's not what happened to me at all. I'm a Kivoker Anochi Ovolei Shikmim. I am a cattle tender and also of Shikmim, of sycamore figs. Rashi says that I know well, or Radak says that I know well how and when to prune trees to make a living. Rashi says it, that I'm good at doing this. I know how to decide when to prune them, and therefore my trees grow better, and therefore I make a good living. But the point is that I'm wealthy. I have plenty of money. I don't need the money. Pasuk Tedvav, Vayigacheni Hashem Yacharei Atzon. Hashem took me from there, from tending the sheep. Vayomer Elei Hashem, Lechi Naveh El Ami Yisrael. And Hashem said to me, no, you have to go and be a Navi, be a prophet to the Jewish people. So that suggestion, or that claim by Amos, that self-representation by Amos is important for a couple of different reasons. So first of all, just to go back to Rabbi Eliezer for a second, we had mentioned Rabbi Eliezer before, that Rabbi Eliezer was the guy who in Bava Metzia gets excommunicated and he cries, and then his wife says to him, I knew that you're crying and you're being upset would lead to somebody being punished, because we have a tradition that Sharei Dima and Sharei Ona'a are never closed. The gates of crying and then the gates of being taunted are never closed. So he, late in another setting, in Vayikra Rabba, tells his wife that he knows a certain student in the basement is going to die within a year, and or within a week, and then he dies, and they say, how do you know? And they say, are you a Navi? And he says, Lo Navi Anochi, Lo Ben Navi Anochi. But I have a tradition that whoever does whatever it is will soon pass away. So that was that phrase we saw before. That's an example of using it in rabbinic literature. So coming back now to the Gemara in Nedarim, Daf Lamed Chet Amud Aleph, has a discussion there of the qualification you need to have a Navi. So Rabbi Yochanan says, one of them is you have to be wealthy. And so the Rambam famously suggested that wealthier doesn't mean actual wealth, it means being comfortable with what you have and being fully in control of your desires, right? You're happy with what you have. But the Gemara here seems to talk about wealth, regular wealth, because in Moshe Rabbeinu it says that I never took anything from the Jewish people, and for Amos, take what are possible. I had a perfectly good living, and so that I didn't need any of that stuff. But it's also useful to think about this perek, about this pasuk, because he says Hashem took me. That seems to imply, you don't have to say that this is true, but it seems to imply that Amos had not made any extraordinary attempts to become a Navi, and Hashem chose him to be a Navi. The reason I focus on that or wonder about that is that the Rambam elsewhere believes or argues that becoming a Navi is something you have to sort of work at or try at. You have to prepare yourself for it. Meditate and study and think and contemplate and work towards an understanding of Hashem. There are all sorts of preparatory things that the Rambam seems to require and see as necessary for becoming a Navi. The question is, what would the Rambam do with a pasuk like our pasuk? It might be the Rambam would say that when he says, I didn't want to be a Navi, he didn't mean I didn't want to be a Navi in terms of having words from Hashem, but he just means I did not strive or intend that I would become a kind of a Navi who has to go and give those nevuot out to the Jewish people of things like destruction. So, something like that. But what he's saying is, I didn't ask for this in what I'm getting now. And then he says, you're telling me not to give nevua, as if you can just suppress it. Your wife will sell herself, right? Play the harlot in the city. Meaning she will make herself free, she will look for, so it's not clear exactly what they mean, but I think it might mean, or my understanding would be, that she will feel the need to do so to save her life. When your children will die by the sword when there's an invasion that's coming. So that would be what the wife being tizneh would mean as well, that she will give herself up, she will sell herself, she will make herself free so that she can live. And your land will be divided up by a measuring line, and you're going to lose all of your land. And you will die on a foreign soil. And the northern kingdom, at least in Israel, will be exiled. So that Amos, and if you only, so Amatzia could easily have walked away from this direction, thinking, oh, Amos always has bad things to say about the Jewish people, always is strict with us, always is concerned to give us a bad prediction, and complain about that and be unhappy or annoyed or upset about that. That would not be an accurate picture, however, as we've seen, because we had the first part of the parak. The first part of the parak we saw that Amos is in fact the one who saved the Jewish people, the northern kingdom, from much, much worse punishments that Hashem had planned and that would have been appropriate and plausible and just. So that part of the lesson in this parak, I think, is that the picture we see of Nevi'im is not always the picture, the full picture of it, and our experience of them and what they say and what they do is not always the whole story. And also, the focus on Anach, especially as the Gemara has it, of taunting and teasing and being mean in a verbal kind of a way, so that sheds light on the second part of the story, where exactly what Amatya does is the kind of thing that Amos had just been told would be the kind of a sin that Hashem would feel the need to step in and to punish. The last piece of the parak that I want to focus on is that whole idea of Adamat Me'at Tamut, dying in a foreign and impure soil. So what's so terrible about that? So first, I'll just point out that Sifrei says, points to this and says that it's one of the examples of showing you that Galut is like the worst punishment you can have. So why is that? It's because, I think it's because of the separation from the land of Israel, being separated from the shefa, from the divine influence that exists there, and that we were meant to be able to partake of. And the dying in a foreign and impure and defiled land is in and of itself a terrible punishment. And in that context, I'll just point out the Gemara Ketubot, Daf Kuf Yud Aleph, Amud Aleph, tells the following story. Amar Rav Anan, Kol HaKavur Be'eretz Yisrael, he was buried in Eretz Yisrael, Kilu Kavur Tachal Mizbeach, as if they're buried under the altar, meaning in a very holy, very sanctified place. Then it tells the following sad story. Ula used to visit Eretz Yisrael regularly. But when he passed away in Chutz Laretz. When they mentioned that to Rabbi Elazar, who knew him from his visits, he was distressed about it. Ant Ula, he says, you, Ula, should also have this experience of Admat Me'at Tamut, of dying in a foreign, defiled land. So they said to him, don't worry about it. Amru Lo, Aronobo, he's going to be buried here in Eretz Yisrael. Amar Lahem, so he says to them, Eino Dome Kolato Mechayim, Kolato Le'achar Mita. It's not the same thing to have been absorbed in the land of Israel when you're alive, to the other possibility of being absorbed within the land of Israel when you passed away. In other words, Rabbi Elazar doesn't deny that being buried in Eretz Yisrael has a tremendous value, and that it is an experience of being absorbed, being nikalat by Eretz Yisrael, but it's not the same. And the not the same is the sad thing, and it's talking about al adamat tmei tamut. So I think many of my listeners are people who live in galut, as I do, and I think that we would do well to carry with us the awareness of al adamat me'at hamut, of the possibility of dying in the chutz laretz, even if we do the proper and right thing of desiring and seeking to be buried in Eretz Yisrael. It will not be the same as if we manage to find our way there within our lifetimes. So all of this is some of the themes, some of the issues that Amos brings up for us in this very interesting parak of burial in Eretz Yisrael, being in Eretz Yisrael, of avoiding ona'ad dvarim, avoiding hurting others with our words, of being aware of our nevim as people who not only tell us what we're doing wrong, not only predict to us the punishment that we deserve, but also, when the occasion arises, save us from ourselves and save us from the fullest measure of divine punishment. Have a great day.